Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I am reading through the Hugo Award winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Jeff Palermo of Sci-Fi On Screen, and he has chosen for us to discuss Hyperion, the 1990 Hugo winner from Dan Simmons. So, Jeff, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Seth. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we connected a while back, kind of through, I think, I can't even remember what it was. I think I found, like, you had linked to us on your site when you were pretty early on, I think, in yours.
I did. I wanted to, you know, sort of find a little collective. So I grabbed a bunch of podcasts that I like listening to, and I put them on my links page. So if folks didn't necessarily like my rather laborious scene-by-scene approach, they would go somewhere else and find different types. And, you know, and I thought it would just be a way to, like, you know, say hey to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, that was cool. So let's talk just a little bit about you and talk about Sci-Fi On Screen as well. So how about kind of some of your history? Where's your geekdom come from, and how did your podcast come about?
Geekdom definitely came from childhood. I mean, my dad took me, without telling me what he was doing, he took me to the movies one fateful day in 1977. Uh-huh. Walked out of there a changed man or a changed child. So that would kind of really, that really kicked off almost everything. And then, strangely enough, you know, there wasn't a ton of visual SF in the movies before Star Wars. I mean, there was, but not, you know, more for adults, I guess. Sci-fi was kind of an adult thing in the 70s. Sure. Where for kids, there wasn't much, and there was no VCRs, so there was very little product. So I went right into books from there. And so my geekdom was really reading a lot of sci-fi and a lot of fantasy, but Star Wars definitely kicked it off for sure.
Talking about books, I usually ask people how many of the Hugo winners they've read, and I don't think I prepared you for that, though.
You did. I think I put a number up here, because you in one of the things you sent me. So I've read 19 of them.
Okay. So you're a few ahead of me. I think I'm up to 14 now.
Oh, nice. So, okay. You know. Okay.
I mean, that's kind of the whole reason for doing this, right, is that I looked at the list. I'm like, wow, I've read 12 of those out of the, you know, if you count the retro Hugos, it's like 70. I think it's right at 70.
Wow.
Yeah, I felt like that's got to change. But so you're saying that books were kind of your, I mean, Star Wars is kind of the gateway drug, right? But then books were kind of where your love of science fiction really took off?
Yeah, I mean, from after Star Wars, and I ran out, and like, I think that same year they published, or a little bit later, that Alan Dean Foster, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, right. Which I think was originally going to, was sort of a sketch for a very low budget sequel to Star Wars. If Star Wars didn't hit, that George kind of had a low budget sequel ready. And I think it was that. I don't know. It might be, this might be, you know, Legends of Star Wars material, but I think that was case. And then when it was huge, he basically gave that draft to Alan Dean Foster, who novelized it. So from there, I think then it was Dune 2001, and Foundation was an early one that I found, and Childhood's End. So Clark and Asimov definitely were two big ones for me. But so definitely through books was primarily how I experienced science fiction. And only, I'm trying to remember when most people got. Do you remember when, like, VCRs became, you know, like in everyone's house, like what year that was?
I don't remember when they were in everyone's house. I vividly remember going to the video store and renting a VCR.
Wow.
And you know, renting a couple movies with it. But I can't remember. It had to be early 80s.
Wow. Okay.
You know, like 82, 83, somewhere in there.
Yeah. Because it wasn't much, you know. I think when my appetite was whetted with Star Wars, as a kid, you went back and a few things popped. Like Planet of the Apes, obviously, was something that when I finally rented it, was like, whoa. But, you know, so much more was to come that I think really books kind of led me really into books from then on. And then The Escape from New York was, I think, a seminal moment. And again, I hadn't seen Alien either because it was rated R, so like my parents would go see Alien. So I didn't see Alien until I was in my 20s. I begged and pleaded them to allow me to see Escape from New York because I saw the trailers on TV. I was like, I have to see this movie. So that was like the beginning of the dystopic sci-fi stuff that I started seeing. And then, of course, I'm sure you can relate to it, like Star Trek, the original series was kind of the main line that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I was into it as much until I saw Star Wars. And then I was like a rabid watcher of the reruns.
Hmm. For me, I really don't remember life before Star Trek or Star Wars.
Got it.
Like, as far as I know, my whole life I've known about those. Because my oldest sister is your age. We've talked about this offline. And she was, you know, she liked Lord of the Rings and they liked Star Trek and all that kind of stuff. And so I kind of followed them to that, which was interesting. And my dad was a science fiction fan as well.
Right.
So how'd your podcast come to be? And how long you been doing it?
So the podcast is a little over 2 years old, and I think, you know, most of my life, I haven't found simpatico movie watchers to really geek out over sci-fi mm-hmm. films with. And the past 4 or 5 years, I finally met a good friend of mine. His name is Mike, who we go to the movies all the time, and we're like movie maniacs. Like, we go see a movie and then we'll walk for like hours afterwards, just completely deconstructing it and talking about it. And we love movies and we see them a lot together. But still, like, he's not a huge genre fan. So there was still a part of me that was like, I think after years and years of watching movies, like, I just had so many bloody opinions about why I think certain ones were good, why certain ones were bad. And, you know, creatively, there was, I think, a couple of years stretch where I wasn't really sure where I was going. I was a semi-pro musician in my 20s. That kind of petered out. I've been trying to write fiction for years. That's been a struggle. And then somehow this just came together. And I just was like, all right, this would be awesome. I'll just talk through a movie scene by scene and, you know, talk about what I like about it, what I don't like about it. So I tried it for a couple of episodes. I think the first three Matrix films were my first ones, and I loved it. I was like, oh, this is awesome. No one else is here. I can just talk.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, either people will like it or they won't. So then that was like 2015, I think. Maybe 2014. I think like October, November 2014. So then I went to this guy, Cliff Ravencraft's site, who's like, it was like soup to nuts how do you start a podcast, which was great. Right. And I took his advice about, you know, hosting the file somewhere else, doing the podcast kind of as a blog. And, you know, within a couple of months, it was ready to go. iTunes link, boom, and it was up.
Sweet.
So how did yours derive? Like, how did you get to yours?
I mean, it was a similar process, really. You know, Colin and James and I, for a long time, James was hired at my work. And Colin and I had been friends from church for a long time, and we had been running together just to, you know, stay in decent shape. And James started joining us, and we would often talk about, you know, science fiction television or movies or whatever. And at some point we're like, hey, let's read a book and talk about it. And I believe the book was Odd Thomas, actually. It was one that Colin and I really liked, and it was on sale at the time in the Kindle store and the Nook store. And so as we were talking through that, I'm like, okay, you guys, I got an idea. I want to do, and the original pitch was let's do a podcast about science fiction that's adapted from books, but I want to focus. And the original focus was for like cheesy 1970s, 1960s, Charlton Heston kind of movies, you know, The Omega Man, Planet of the Apes, Soylent Green. And so as we started looking through the list of adapted works, we just found that it's so huge, and we couldn't in good conscience just limit ourselves to just the cheesy ones. And because we wanted to do some current stuff as well. So that's just kind of the way it came. Like you said, like conversations that we would normally have are like, hey, let's just record those and
see how it goes. So
that's great.
I guess we can kind of move into talking about the book, but the first thing I want to ask you is why Hyperion? Because when I think you were the first person I contacted actually about this, that, hey, I've got this idea, and I might like to do this. You think you'd be interested in doing something, and you pounced on Hyperion.
You know, first of all, I had just reread it. I think like 6 or 7 months ago I had reread it. And, it's probably my favorite modern, like Dune and Hyperion are probably my two favorites. But Hyperion, I think, because, you know, when I was young in high school, like, you know, my literary taste in reading things was like, just there are words on the page and there's a story, you know, like I had no sense of good writing. But in my 20s, I started to just branch out and really get into some heavy reading, and just on my own wanted to read the classics and read and really learn about literary style. And just, it was a natural thing that I wanted to do. And unfortunately, the more I got into better books, like, it was just harder and harder to go back and read sci-fi because, you know, in my opinion, so much of it is just really poorly written. I mean, the ideas are incredible, but there's a lot of bad writing in the genre. There just is. So when I came across Hyperion, like in the mid 90s, after, you know, I had been putting down some really heavy duty books, I was like, oh my God. Number one, it's, you know, and when we talk about the non-spoiler synopsis, I can get into that, but there's a literary background to the whole structure of it. And at that point, Simmons could write. Like, I don't like a lot. Most of the stuff that I've read other than Hyperion falls so below for me. But I thought, man, here's a guy who can write and he's treating literary themes and he's, you know, he's doing all this stuff. And then, you know, then it had the sci-fi thing on top of it, of like incredible world building and great characters. And it just took my head off. I thought, wow. So I don't always hear it. I mean, it's always in like the best of lists, right? But I don't hear it with the regularity as I hear Dune and Heinlein stuff and Asimov. I don't hear Simmons' name as much regularly. So I thought, hey, this would be a good way to just, you know, talk about this, what I think is this great book, to people who may not have read it before.
Yeah. And this is one for me that I kept seeing it in lists, but I wasn't sure that it was like, you know, something that would be comparable with Heinlein and Asimov and Clarke, which the funny thing is when I read a lot of those, like Clarke and Asimov, I feel like the ideas they come up with are great. And it's kind of like you're talking about where, but the writing isn't always amazing. And Hyperion, I had heard, was a highly literary book. And I really enjoy that. And, you know, I like a palate cleanser sometimes of something super pulpy.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kind of the draw of it was that literary element. And I had picked it up, and just between whatever else I was doing, I never made it to any of the tales at the core of the book. And so I was like, okay, I gotta come back to this when I can actually sit down and enjoy it. And so I bought it and just, I'm like, okay. And then when you mentioned it, I thought, great, this is the perfect pretext for me to read this book that I've been wanting to read.
Oh, that's great. That's perfect. I mean, actually, and that's perfect. That's good. It's you coming to it in that way is actually perfect of trying to get it more known, you know? So that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So why don't we march ahead with the non-spoiler section, and we will get into spoilers. So anybody listening, you know, you can kind of listen to this section and decide if you want to read this book. So before we end the non-spoiler section, we'll give you our overall thoughts on it and, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down. And I think I can predict it. So how about that elevator pitch for it, the non-spoiler synopsis?
Okay. So the Hyperion elevator pitch is basically the Canterbury Tales in space, which is you've got six characters point of view, and it's based on the Canterbury Tales, which is there's the Pilgrim's Tale, the whatever's tale. So those even those chapter titles come from the Canterbury Tales. I don't know if they're one-on-ones. Obviously there's no detective's tale in the Canterbury Tales, but
right.
So he takes the structure from that, and I have not read the Canterbury Tale, so I don't know if he takes anything else from it. But basically it's these six pilgrims on their way to a planet named Hyperion, and all of them are somehow connected with the greater mystery of the planet. And on the way there, they're sharing their stories with each other and with the reader. And as you continue to progress through the stories, you learn a little bit more about the world at large, the plot and the ideas, until the end of the book when they finally get to Hyperion. And it's the first of two books in one large story. And then there's another two books that take place many years after this first, they call Hyperion Cantos, ends. So, you know, to back it off to a log line, I would say, you know, Canterbury Tales in space.
Nice. I'm not certain that that's what's going to attract people to it. I mean, the Canterbury Tales is not I don't think it's a very commonly read thing by non-English majors.
Right.
I actually picked it up on audio last week just because I was curious. I wanted to, if nothing else, I wanted to kind of look at the table of contents and see what it was about. But yeah, there is stuff like the Bard's Tale and the Priest's Tale.
Right. Right.
But it's, you know, it's told in verse as well. So it's, quite different. And I think it's from like the 15th century.
Yeah. So how would you, what would your version of a non-spoiler be?
That would pretty much be it.
Yeah,
I'm just curious. It's great. I'm really looking forward to hearing your ideas on it because I've read it for so many times, and no one I know has read it, so I've never actually talked about it with anyone who has also read it. So I'm looking forward to your first blush of it.
Cool. Yeah, and that's actually one thing that I really like about the fact that I haven't read so many of these is that I get to kind of be that first reader perspective and get lots of times to have somebody who's like really passionate about it to have like a multiple read, more considered opinion on things.
Right.
That's kind of where we are, right? Overall thoughts from both of us. So you want to talk about your history with it?
I read it in, I think, the mid 90s. So maybe 4 or 5 years after it was published. I didn't really know much about it, but there was a time when my music career was kind of winding down and I was like, you know, I don't really know that I'm going to be a professional musician for the rest of my life. And when I was younger, you know, being a huge fan of the genre, I thought, you know, as optimistic kids will do, I'd be like, well, you know what? I'm a great drummer, so I'm going to have this music career first. And then when I get older and I don't want to tour anymore, I'm going to write science fiction, you know, and that'll be my second career. Mm-hmm. And so there I was in my early 30s, and I thought, well, why wait? You know, let's jump in now. And just around that time, I stumbled upon it and read it. And it was, I think I probably, upon reading it, it kicked off the idea of like, oh man, I can do this. Something about what he did made me think, not that I could write a book as good as Hyperion, but there was just something about reading it where I thought, because even the modern space operas that are, you know, the new space opera, which is highly touted right now, like so often it's like chewing cardboard for me. It's just so hard to get through.
Yeah.
They don't have a lot of literary qualities. And, you know, if you're reading sci-fi for the ideas and some of the vistas, then that's great. So when I saw that, hey, someone could bring a literary sensibility to the world in a way that's not so postmodern that I hate it, you know, that like he brought kind of an older sensibility to a genre, I thought, oh my God, I can, you know, I would love to do stuff like this. And so, you know, I tore through it and the sequel. And at the time, the Endymion books hadn't come out yet. So it was just those two. And I thought, my God, it was just phenomenal. The world building was incredible. And really hit me straight away, like what an amazing feat. And I immediately put it up with the Pantheon. I thought this is right up there with Dune and, you know, and Clark's stuff. So it was pretty powerful.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, just first impressions of this book are, I mean, it's hard to pin down, you know, hard to put in words how amazing this book actually is. Because like you said, with the kind of six narratives that you have in there, any one of those could have been picked up and expanded into an entire novel by itself. And it's like he took six novellas, managed to put them in the same universe and tied them together, you know, with a little bit of a thread. And I'm wondering, and this is something that maybe you can tell me, if you get more of what the connection is between everybody in the future book.
Oh, you mean in the Fall of Hyperion?
Yeah. Maybe we should table that for spoiler section.
Yeah, and only because, you know what, I haven't gone on to reread it in a while, so it's very complicated, and I don't know that I could pull out of memory at this point.
Right, and it can be tough too to if you've read a whole series to remember where did that one end and the next one start.
Exactly.
Yeah. But like you said, the world building. This is something that lots of times world building, like in fantasy novels, like in Tolkien, it's stuff that I don't appreciate, you know, like pages and pages of just prose, just narrative, of descriptions of hills and mountains and that kind of stuff. And that's a different kind of world building than you have in a lot of science fiction, because you have to build a whole universe, right?
And
the scope of the universe that Simmons creates in Hyperion and the variety of things that he puts into it is just amazing, because he's got, like, you know, the sentient AIs and the skin job AIs, you know, teleportation, sort of, you know, faster than light travel, tree ships. I mean, what the heck are tree ships, you know? And right. So many things where he just drops it on you and says, you know, he uses a word like the world web. You're like, well, I guess he's going to explain that at some point.
Right.
But doesn't take the time to just break it down for you like a hard science fiction author would. And I just thought it was tremendous how by the time I got, you know, halfway through the book, I'm like, okay, I trust this guy to explain anything that I need explained. And I don't think there's anything that dropped that I'm like, well, I didn't get that though. So,
and that's, yeah. I think that's the test of a really good writer, where he's not telling you everything, but there's just enough and you're on board, you're willing to hang in there, which avoids the, you know, well, John, let me explain about the magnetic rings covering the space station, you know, that kind of crap just thud drops in the middle of a book. So it was really great to hear you say that, because I think that's really true here.
Yeah. Or like, you familiar with TV Tropes?
Yes.
Site? They have a thing on there called the Expositron 2000, where it's like a computer that explains some key plot point. No clunky exposition in this one.
Nope.
So, and this is one where I'm really going to have to lean on you, I think, because I have come to reading science fiction much more recently. Reading was something that I liked in grade school, and then I just hated from there until college. And being in a technical field in college, you know, studying electrical engineering, I needed like an artistic outlet. And actually for me, I sing. And so I did that. That was kind of my artistic outlet, but reading was the other one. And, I've kind of more recently come into reading science fiction, and so a long way to ask, what do you think, like, fans of what other novels or series or films or anything might enjoy Hyperion?
Unfortunately, films, I would say not many. It's the science fiction film, I think, is a whole different animal in that it's not necessarily multi-layered. And the beautiful thing about these sort of architectonic sci-fi novels is they're just, you know, they sprawl. And you can have these long, involved narratives that do a lot of things. And so I don't think film comes, that's, I think sci-fi really for me, you know, sci-fi films are an amazing experience, but the sci-fi novels is a very special thing. And so I think if you've loved, if you like the better sci-fi novels, if you like Dune, if you like 2001 or Childhood's End, things of that nature, Ursula K. Le Guin stuff, that's really well written, I think you'll like Hyperion. And the thing is, with Hyperion, I think if you're a non-sci-fi fan, I think this is the thing that I wanted to say on the show today, is that non-sci-fi fans who dabble a little bit, I think, are the best audience for this, because they'll recognize the literary tropes going on in the book. And I think it'll draw them in. And then it's almost like, you know, the pill goes down with a little sugar, you know, like if you're right. a literary reader who's not into genre, you know, your BS meter probably goes on really quickly. But I think with this book, you'll be seduced into, you know, suspending your disbelief because of how well it's done.
Yeah, I think the only worry I would have there is that some of the kind of trust as a science fiction fan that I had, that, you know, he was going to explain what a Farcaster was, that he was going to explain what the World Web was, some of those things might actually throw somebody who wasn't a science fiction fan already. But I do agree that, like, the literary quality of it, especially when, I can't remember, let's see, what is the first tale that's told? Is it
the Priest's Tale?
It is the Priest's Tale. And that is a good one to start with. I think that was a smart one to go with. And so, yeah, I do feel like that would pull somebody in.
Yeah, you're right. And what about you? What do you think in terms of, you know, do you think there's a filmic sensibility that would bring someone to Hyperion, or like, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you that science fiction films don't excel at the kind of storytelling that Hyperion does. And really these days, you know, the only way that I could see this working for adaptation, would be a television series.
Like a Netflix 10 episode
a limited series probably. And I mean, you could do the Hyperion Canto, so you could do a multi-season thing. But, and I do want to talk about that a little bit later on, because I know that it has been optioned. At some point, somebody optioned it to turn the first two books into one film.
Right. Scorsese was going to do it at one point, which probably the Priest's Tale hooked him in, and the, you know, the Scholar's Tale. But I think Bradley Cooper now owns the rights to it, and I think he's trying to get it made.
Yeah, I know he's connected to it.
One way or the other. I would, so like you, I think you're right. I would so like to see it on the small screen and not the big screen, because,
yeah,
you know, you're just more latitude to tell the story without having to make $1 zillion opening weekend.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I can't think of anything that I would necessarily think, well, if you've read this, then you'd like Hyperion, just because I feel like I'm not well read enough. Though I do agree that science fiction books with big concepts in them are kind of the type of books that you might have read that you think, well, I want something else like that. And something like Dune, which I did for episode number two, is probably something that, like, if you've read Dune, you might enjoy Hyperion.
I would say, too, I don't think it's on the same level, but I think if you're like a Peter F. Hamilton fan and I read the Night's Dawn trilogy, which I really liked, but I've tried some of his other Commonwealth books, and he's like Alistair Reynolds. Like, they just, at one point, I think their editors leave the country. They just, the publishers are just like, well, you're popular, so whatever you write, we'll put it out, you know?
But I feel like
someone like Hamilton writes similar in the sense that actually in his Commonwealth series, he steals the Farcaster thing, which, you know, is kind of a sci-fi trope. I wouldn't say he stole it, but he borrows it to also create the civilization in his novels. So I think if you're a Hamilton fan, I think this is a little elevated above Hamilton, but I think it would be an easy jump over for those kind of people who like his works to jump in and feel at home with, okay, it's going to, you know, this is a really epic story. It's going to take its time. I love the genre. I love, you know, things. They'll have patience for it, and they'll feel kind of at home in the world, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like, if nothing else, we're both saying, yes, absolutely, this is a good one to read.
Yeah.
I'm actually putting together a page for the podcast website for, like, my running rankings of everything I've read so far, and I'm acknowledging that it's probably going to be heavily recency biased, because having just read Dune and just read Hyperion, I think I put Hyperion on top, but I've read Dune a couple times. So, you know, on rereads, I might reorder. So
we'll
see. I haven't published it yet, but I will probably by the time the episode goes up, and it's only three at this point. So
got it.
I think it's time to get into spoilers, Jeff.
Let's spoil the book.
Yes. Let us do that. So everybody, we're both saying absolutely read this book, kind of essential science fiction reading. It definitely makes it onto those big lists where like that show up on Facebook. How many of these science fiction books have you read? I'm glad I can mark that one off now. All right. So spoiler talk. So anything you want to get into, you know, highlights, lowlights, themes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I wanted to get into is the world building to start.
Yeah.
That the Farcaster, the way he built this entire civilization on Farcaster technology, I thought was just astonishing.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, you have these Farcaster hubs in each city and certain planets only have one, certain planets have them everywhere. Mm-hmm. To the, which one of my favorite things in this book is the Farcaster house.
Yeah.
One of the coolest things I've ever read. Yep. That, you know, you would have a house in each room. If you were in your living room and you decided to walk into your bedroom, you would pass through a Farcaster and be at the other end of the galaxy on right. another planet, which might even have different gravity. And the incredible part of it, well, you haven't read Fall of Hyperion, so you haven't finished the story, so I have to be careful right. not to spoil okay. certain things. But yeah, I thought that the world building based on Farcaster technology was just phenomenal. I mean, how did you find it?
Yeah, I thought it was amazing. And I really do like when, you know, the kind of the heart of sci-fi is, here's this technology. How does it change things? And what are the applications of it? Because lots of times you'll have some piece of technology and it's used in a certain way, but none of the corner cases are explored for, you know, well, but let's take this to its logical conclusion. How might it be used? And with the Farcaster, yeah, the idea that, well, you could live on one planet, but have your bedroom on a different planet and have, you know, a seaside view on a different planet. Yeah, it's just incredible. And the idea of, and this kind of gets into some of the, into the hegemony and the wealth of people in the hegemony, where, you know, the idea of maintaining a house like that, the cost in
yes.
money and in, you know, whatever resource it has to be used, you know, the singularities that have to be produced for the Farcasters is something else. But have you recently read iRobot?
I have, you know, I've never made it through iRobot. I've tried multiple times, but, and to me, Asimov is not a very good writer. Like,
yeah,
he's a very functional writer. Foundation I can read. Foundation is very clean, and I think he's better at his novels. But the stories in iRobot are just, they're so dated. They're so pulp magazines, you know, Astounding Stories 1940, that I cannot get through them. And even though I'm recognizing as I read them that the clever ideas he's using, I'm just like, I can't do it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I ever will finish it.
Huh. See, I adore iRobot. And I know I can put myself in the right frame of mind for that, right? This is very of its time. We're talking vacuum tubes here. And gender roles that aren't necessarily what you'd like to see.
Yeah. But, and that I don't mind. I could do that either. Like, that's part of the time. So I never find that. I have to put my, I envy you because I kind of have to put my head back to like, just ignore the writing, just read the book, you know?
Yeah. It's all about plot and not about writing, right? Concepts and not characters and amazing prose or anything like that. But they're in iRobot, there's the characters Powell and Donovan. And at some point they're like the, faster than light drive guys, you know, like they're working on testing one. And then at some point in the book, they are like putting teleportation pods or that kind of thing on these planets that are far out. And they're kind of obsoleting themselves because nobody will need the faster than light ship after when they can just step through a portal to a different world. But that's kind of what this reminded me of, the Farcasters.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, another thing in his book is that he borrows, I think, with homage from other writers and uses it himself. So I think that the like Ceres tale and the time debt stuff is from The Forever War by Joe Haldeman, which I don't know if you've read.
Yeah, I recently read that one.
So I feel like he's cribbing a little bit of that. And then there's a lot of William Gibson in The Detective's Tale.
Yes.
To the point where even there's a character, you know, mentioned offhand, you know, back in the day, the first days of The Matrix, Cowboy Gibson did X, Y, and Z. So he's even, you know, he's sort of doing his cover tunes in a way. Mm-hmm. Which I think he does for at least a couple of the stories, that he's using other stuff from other writers, but in a way where he's putting his own unique spin on it. And it's a gentle borrowing that I think, you know, in today's, you know, litigious atmosphere, I don't know how much you get away with that anymore. But I think, you know, in the sci-fi genre, it's sort of like there are main ideas that everyone knows about, that everyone just uses, and no one lays claim to them, like telecasters are mine and laser guns is his and we're copywriting it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I enjoyed that, in a sense, Hyperion was nodding to what had come before while he was then putting his own spin and pushing it forward. I don't know if you felt that way.
Yeah, I definitely did. I felt like the kind of the six tales were like a grab bag of different kinds of science fiction, because you have the sort of military science fiction one when it's, you know, it's the soldier's tale, right?
Cassad, yeah.
Yeah. And then you had the priest's tale, and you kind of have the implications of you know, a larger universe on religion, kind of tale there.
Right.
And you had the cyberpunk one and a detective story at the same time in that kind of cyberpunk universe.
Which made me think of Asimov's actually first robot novel, which was a detective story. And I was just, now that we're talking about it, it's just dawning on me. And I'm wondering if there's a little similarity there.
Right. Where you're pairing up a human with a non-human.
Right. So what about you? What's something something in the book that kind of popped for you?
So the big thing, and this is where I want to get into, I'll need your opinion on what it's like on rereads, because for me, the biggest delight in this book was the way Simmons subverted my expectations. So he took my first impressions, and I don't know if this is something that always happens. And so I'll want to know from you, on your first read, your first impressions of everybody, because when I first read it, you know, I started looking at some of these characters and I'm like, I don't like this guy. I'm not going to like this guy. He's a poet. He's that arty guy that didn't have to do hard work in college. Or at least that was my perspective, right? Doing technical classes in college. I remember I'd come back from my dorm, you know, after pulling an all-nighter studying for organic chemistry or something. And there'd be these literature majors, you know, sitting there just having a blast in the common area. And I'm like, I hate you people right now. And yet I also hung out with like the music majors, and I know that their upper division stuff is no picnic. So I know that I was of course way off back then, and I know that I'm way off now in kind of my assessment of people. And one of the really negative views that I had was Saul Weintraub, because here's this older guy with a baby, and I'm like, seriously, you adopted a toy baby? You know, come on, man. And then you hear his tale, and it is so heartbreaking.
Right.
When you find out about that she's aging in reverse, and as a father, you know, that just punched me in the gut, and you know, I deserved it for unfairly judging all the people at the beginning. All the way down to like the consul, because I'm like, okay, the consul's our hero, right? He's the good guy, and the hegemony is good, right? And you get to his tale and you're like, wow, the hegemony are bastards.
Yeah.
So
You know what, that's great. That's something that I wouldn't have thought of. I think that I'm glad you brought that up. And your first blush is because I think you're exactly right that, you know, going back rereads, I know them now. I know who they are and where they go in the story. So I don't remember what I thought of them in the first one. So I was really interesting to hear that. And especially, you know, I don't have children. So, you know, and you do, and your experience of the scholar's tale, yours versus mine. So I appreciate that as well. That's and I think it's good that the really great books are ones that you can hook into on any level. You know, you can hook into as just, you know, superficial entertainment, or, you know, maybe on a second or third reread, or when your life experience changes, you can re-experience the book in a different way because there's stuff in you now that's wasn't before, that's, and you see it in the book, you know? So it's cool to hear.
Yeah. And the other thing that I really like is that as I read, you know, each one of these characters is really, really well served in the book. You know, they're a lot of science fiction is big on concept and big on plot, but not big on character. And this is absolutely an exception to that.
Yeah, which is, you know, for genre stuff, it's very rare, you know, that you get well-drawn characters that pull you through the world. And I think, you know, genre doesn't have to suck. It doesn't have to be, you know, pulpy, and doesn't have to be bad. And I think a book like this is like how much better everything is when you're experiencing it through the viewpoint of a really sympathetic character or a really complex character, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because they're not all necessarily sympathetic, but definitely there's the complexity there, and you kind of understand where everybody's coming from by the end of the book.
Exactly, exactly.
So kind of going back to the idea of the hegemony, you know, I was looking at it like, I'm not even sure what to get. In science fiction, lots of times the big powerful entity is the bad guy, right?
Right.
But somehow I was looking at it as, okay, this is a good thing, right? It's bringing all these systems together. But then when you find out through the consul's tale, the way they bring people together, oftentimes by, you know, a scorched earth approach, it's kind of, it's expansion and exploitation, right? The dark side of manifest destiny. If you look at the history of the United States, right?
Yep.
You know, westward movement, and okay, let's move all the competitive societies out of our way and walk over them.
Right.
And that's definitely like that's explicitly there, right? Like if there's any species that seems to be a threat to the hegemony, well, then we're going to discard them.
Because the ousters ultimately are painted in a very sympathetic light. When you come to see them and what they're after, you're just like, oh, these are the good guys, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah. They're the Rebel Alliance, right?
And it's Fall of Hyperion really wraps everything up. So if you're interested in how all this ties together, you know, he does it in a nice, neat little bow. So if you have time, I would say, you know, get into Fall of Hyperion because all the questions in that way will be answered.
Okay. And that was something that I was going to count on you to let me know if I should continue. Because I've been hovering over the purchase button for the last couple of days.
It's a lesser book in terms of literary style, but now since you're so invested in the story, you kind of need it to, because it's, you know, there's so much hanging at that last book. You know, you don't really know anything about why things are happening and the deep background and everything and how it all comes to a close. So you kind of need to, so hit that button. I would highly suggest it.
Well, and this kind of gets into, if you can call it the one negative of the book, is that it's the journey. It's not the destination. This book is the journey. Literally. So if you're looking for something that wraps up really nicely, this book is not it. And I have been told that you need to read the Hyperion Cantos in twos, right? Read Hyperion and the Fall of Hyperion as a set if you want to get the complete story.
Yeah, because, well, Simmons even said that he wrote it as one book, but as publishers, they didn't want to publish the whole thing. They didn't want to publish like a 1,000-page novel. So they made him break it up into two. So, you know, there are times when things are happening, like even the Foundation trilogy, it's a very artificial thing. There are 9 stories that Asimov wrote, and the publisher put them in 3 books, you know. So
So
I think it was the same with Hyperion, where it ends on that cliff note, that hanger, but if it's all one book, you're just turning the page and you're in the next section. So when you're just getting it as a standalone book, it is quite abrupt.
Yeah.
What I wanted to talk about, did any of the themes of any of the tales kind of, you know, speak to you in any way? And just to speak about some of the themes that he's dealing with in some of these tales.
Well, I mean, so as a first time reader for this, I'm not sure I have a great handle on what the themes are. You know, I haven't had, I literally finished it yesterday, Jeff.
And, oh, wow. Okay.
And so I need some time to sink in some of that stuff. So if you want to kind of spin out some of the themes that you see, then that'd be a good place to jump off for conversation.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, so I felt like, of course, the first one was faith, you know, about this priest who discovers this, you know, who knows what he discovered on Armagast, something that, you know, which was a great, very Clarkian, I thought, you know, that some Christian-ish ruins were discovered on Armagast that existed way before, you know, time of Christ. He's this character that's in the throes of faith and what he believes in. The trouble with the one criticism I have of the book is that I think he sets out in some of these stories to lay out certain themes, but I don't think he quite treats them in a way that's, I don't know, for my money, that are very, you know, like, okay, so this is the priest's tale. But at the end of the tale, the idea is that this priest crucifies himself on the Tesla tree.
Right. Which is another really cool science fiction thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. I haven't even touched on the details of that. It's really neat. But, and it's great. But this, I think thematically, he gets tied up a little bit. I think sometimes the story, he writes these cool stories, but sometimes in the theme, of the priest's tale, like, you know, that he would have to, in a sense, crucify himself to free himself from this parasite. And so even though when I finished the tale multiple times, I'm sort of like, all right, all the pieces are in place here for, like, you know, a rereading of the Christ's tale or the Passion, as it were. And yet it never really hit me on a, you know, on a deep textural level of like, did he say anything new about that? Or did he, the fact that he transposed it into a science fictional setting, did he peel back a little bit of a layer and let me look at it from a new perspective? And I don't think he does. So I was curious about your thoughts on at least that one.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've had enough time to consider that one. And you know, that's the first tale too, right? And so I read that a couple of weeks ago when I started reading.
Got it.
But I did, you know, I do enjoy reading that kind of tale as a person of faith myself, and reading about people struggling with their faith, right? Because the priest goes out there and he's given up essentially, right?
Yeah.
He's one of a few thousand priests left in the Catholic Church, which is all but fallen apart. Yeah. So I found that really, really compelling, but I'm not sure what else to say about it.
Got it. Yeah, because I am a person of faith as well. And so that and the Abraham story, I do love those stories. Like I do love, you know, I just went out and saw Martin Scorsese's Silence, you know, the first opening weekend. And it was an amazing film that dealt with, you know, the question of faith and on many levels. Brilliant movie. And when I came back to Endless, you know, this is just a sci-fi book, but he's throwing it up there. Like, so he's also doing the Tale of Abraham.
Right.
And, you know, he's treating that with the scholar's tale. And yet when I'm finished with the scholar's tale, I'm like, I don't know, Dan. I think he used those stories as a framework to tell his adventure story, which I think is really clever. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't get a profundity out of Hyperion like I get out of Dune or Childhood's End, you know, or 2001, where I walk away, I'm like, whoa, I got to think through some of this stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like Hyperion doesn't have that resonance for me. And I feel like that's the one thing I didn't think worked, where he uses literary models and, you know, and religious stories as well. And I think it's more of a framework to tell the story than, you know, him having this deep knowledge that he wants to share in that tell, you know?
Yeah. And it may be a blind spot on the part of the author, right? It may be him dealing in something that he doesn't have a stake in.
Sure.
Because it's always surprising when you find an author who's like a well-known atheist who writes a compelling religious character.
Right. Right.
And likewise, it's, you look at like Christian films, right? And they'll have an atheist character that's a complete cardboard cutout of all the stereotypes that little religious kids learn about the evil atheists, you know?
That's right.
So yeah, I'm curious as I, you know, when I go back and reread this, you know, if I'll kind of come down on your side on this or if I don't know, I might see something different.
Yeah, I would love to. Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So many of the stories though have such a, they don't end on an up, you know?
Right.
They kind of end on, okay, we're going to punch you in the face here or in the gut.
Yeah.
Because you have the scholar's tale, which, you know, ends with his daughter slowly losing her faculties, right? And becoming younger and younger. And it's very Benjamin Button, very 51st Dates. You know, it's been done in other settings, but in such a heartbreaking way.
Yeah.
And like you said, with the priest tale, right? He ends by helping his fellow priest die. Essentially.
Right. Right.
And the reveal there at the end of the priest tale, when the consul goes to him and says, I want the real story and then I'll give you your drugs.
Yeah.
Where you find out that he's got this cruciform thing that's torturing him and that he has to be completely doped up in order to live off the planet.
Right.
That took me completely by surprise. It never even occurred to me.
Yeah. And that Duray's, he was also holding Duray's cruciform as well as his own, which is amazing. Yeah. And there's a great little throwaway line. It's like, the second one was there, of course, small on the small of his back, you know, that kind of thing where you're like, oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good story. Great storytelling.
Yeah. Well, and they even kind of bring that in, when they realize that one of the people has been evidently slaughtered by the Shrike. Right. And so now they don't have seven. And then they kind of go through it and they're like, well, wait a second. He's got the other priest with him. You know, she's got the, what's it called?
The Keats Cybrid. Yeah.
Yeah. The Keats Cybrid in her. He's got Rachel with him.
That's right. It was never really.
We're a horde of people. Yeah.
right.
And that was a fascinating thing to think about.
Did the Shrike give you Terminator flashbacks?
A bit. Yeah. I can definitely see that. I was surprised, and this is where the book subverted my expectations. Like, I expected to never meet the Shrike in any way.
Right.
And, or at least not until the very end, right? You don't show the shark as little as possible, right?
Right.
And it's, I mean, it's almost an anagram of shark, at least, but phonetically. But so I was surprised when, I think it was the Soldier's Tale where we first actually, no, it was the Priest Tale, right? Because he meets the Shrike when
he climbs.
The Shrike appears there when he gets the cruciform, I think.
Yeah. That would be something in adaptation. I'm not sure that any possible Shrike is going to live up to everything I saw in my head.
Yeah. No, if you go online, some sculptor did one for Simmons. He has it on like his property as like a scarecrow.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, the one on the first two books, the first two paperback editions, are incorrect and they don't show four arms because it's a four-armed creature. And so when you see it on the two, so yeah, it's going to have to be really well designed because, you know, it's described very Lovecraftian, just in all these oblique terms. And, you know, you get the red eyes and then there's just thorns and spikes and the rest you kind of have to flesh out yourself, you know?
Well, yeah. And so much of, and this is the other thing, you know, like thinking about it, adapting The Poet's Tale, where the slaughter begins to occur on,
right,
on Hyperion. You know, how explicit do you go? Because that could be horrifying.
Right. It's a good point. And the Tree of Thorns, too. Like, that's a pretty hardcore image.
Yeah, yeah.
That's going to come up anywhere. But, yeah, I mean, I think you can TV that to a degree that won't really impact the story, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know? If it's Netflix, you can do whatever you want. But, like, if Sci-Fi makes it or something, yeah, it'll pull out some of the bite of that tale. Because it is a... The Poet's Tale is really horrific. And it's I think, the most literary, because it's the least sci-fi feeling tale. This feels sort of like a, you know, like a literary novel, first person point of view. And it's kind of got, it's a little raw and ragged, and there's cursing and a lot of blood. And it's nice that it comes kind of in the middle of things, where it was the most visceral of the tales. And it was, I don't know, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I enjoyed all of them. So I was a little thrown in the console's tail when you found out that Siri was only 15 when this 19-year-old guy was
oops,
knocking boots with her.
Oh, Dan.
Yeah.
Although, you know, too, in a lot of kind of, I'm going to say primitive societies, but this is like a non-technological society, you know, early marriage does tend to occur. So.
Right, right.
So who knows?
Yeah, and I think it was done in such a way where it was, you know, it wasn't done in kind of a creepy way. Like it was,
no,
you know,
it wasn't.
It was kind of a young love. It's kind of like a Romeo and Juliet kind of thing, you know, which I kind of felt, especially the death of his friend. I was like, oh, this is a little R&J going on here.
It is. Yep. A little bit. And I think they brought in a plague upon both your houses.
Ah, probably. Yeah. I don't remember that.
So,
but
yeah. Right. So it was totally read out of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
So.
And he's a big Shakespeare fan, too. He's on his website. He's got these long essays. He writes about Shakespeare, so he's a huge fan.
Nice. Anything else to talk about? I mean, there's tons to talk about. We could talk for 3 hours and not exhaust everything.
I know. No, I think for the most part, I think I got I talked a lot about what I liked about it. And I guess maybe some little details, like you just reminded me of the whole Tesla trees. I think what also I liked, you know, we talk about world building with the forecasters, but he really does build a lot of the worlds in a really great way. Like Hyperion was very fleshed out about where the mountain ranges were as a term, the Bridal Range and the Three Continents. And Maui Covenant is being kind of like, you know, the motile isles and the biological relationship of the dolphins to the isles and the Tesla trees and the flame forest. Like, I feel like every setting, you know, the Lussis, the hive, was it extra gravity? Like, he really thought through how each of these worlds worked. It wasn't just like, you know, a bunch of Earths with cool names. Like, they were, you know, when you went to these places, they were slightly different and they had a different ecology and how the world worked. And I was very impressed with that. I really felt like he really had thought that through, wanting each location to be interesting in a really good, hard, kind of a hard sci-fi way, and that he would look at the relationships between the people and the planet or the flora and fauna, as you were. So I don't know. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. I guess one thing that I wanted to talk about was and it's a large topic, right? AI in Hyperion.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's not a monolithic thing, right? It's not just, well, all the AIs on Earth, you know, got together or I guess it wasn't even on Earth. It was in the whole hegemony and said, all right, you know, we're out. Not like a Terminator uprising or anything like that. Just we're going to go do our own thing. Kind of like, do you ever see Her?
No, I've heard about it, but I never saw it.
Okay. I won't go into more spoilers there. Yeah. Just the idea that then within the Technocore, there's factions, right? Some of them that just want to seek the answer to life, the universe, and everything. and which I think actually they call it ultimate.
Yeah, the volatile, ultimate the ultimates, and then there's another one. I don't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Is there three?
I think there were three, yeah.
Like the volatiles and the faction that wanted to work with humanity, the volatiles who didn't want to, and then the ultimates who didn't care. They were just wanted to build God, basically.
Yeah. I got to know. It's going to bother me.
No, you have to read the second one, because you don't really know anything about the nature of the AIs and where they are. You know, in this book, it's a mystery. Nobody knows where the core actually is. And you're not given that until the second book. And yeah, and there's a lot. So much wraps up. You meet the Ousters in the second book. So
nice.
Yeah, it's great. But the AIs were great. You know, I think in this one, and I could be spoiling a little bit, but was there poetry in this one? Did the AIs do like haiku or no?
No, I don't think we got any poetry from the AIs.
All right, so I'm spoiling a tiny bit of the next one, because there's more conversations about, you know, what the AIs are up to in the next one, and you find out a little bit more about what their deal is.
Computers writing poems reminds me of 1984, where you have the machines that make songs.
Right.
That deliberately target songs to make them earworms. The Stables, by the way, that's the oldest faction.
Stables, thank you. Yes. Excellent.
Yeah, where that's kind of the, okay, we're the Technicore and humanity are, you know, they should be together, right? They need each other. So it's funny because the next book that I'm going to be talking about, Jeff, is Neuromancer.
Oh, God.
And this is one that I have not read. It's another one of those.
Well, you totally can. You can read along.
It's like probably one of my favorites of all time.
Yeah. And that was another one where I asked a number of other people, and I got Hyperion, a Neuromancer, and I can't remember what, and Dune were the other ones that were requested by multiple people.
Yep.
So I had to go, no, Jeff got Hyperion. So
I forgot about Neuromancer. Yeah. That's great. I can't wait to hear your take on it.
Yeah, because it'll be another, you know, first time reader for that. And I think that Lisa, who I'm going to be talking about it with, has read it a number of times. So,
oh, perfect.
Yeah. So that'll be awesome.
And, you know, one thing I wanted to mention too is I like that Simmons puts in mysteries in the book that don't get resolved. And I can say that it doesn't get resolved in any of the books. And it won't ruin anything, but the nine labyrinthine worlds. Which
right.
I thought was what a cool thing. He just stuck it in there, you know, and it plays a little bit of a part in the story when you get through the second one, but you never really know who built them and why and what's the deal. And I think, you know, part of a literary effect that a book has is, you know, putting things in the book that just are strange and that will just inspire you to come up with ideas on your own in your head. And the book will never pay off on it rather than having every bloody thing explained at the end of the book. Whereas, you know, having read the Hyperion books through, like even finishing all four of them, there are still mysteries in those books that Simmons will never resolve. And so it's kind of cool that it remains more of a living world, because I haven't, you know, like these new Alien films that are coming out, like they're going to pin down every last, you know, mystery that ever existed in any of the Alien films to the point that like nothing will be unrevealed. You'll know absolutely everything. And in a sense, you know, ruin the mystery of where these beings came from and your ability to come up with a backstory on your own. And I feel like that's what Simmons does, that at least probably with a couple of other things, but with the labyrinth worlds, I thought this is great. Like who did make them and when, and they're older, they're billions of years old and they're only on stable planets, you know? So I don't know. I very much enjoyed that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I have to agree with you that, you know, having specific but unsatisfying answers to questions is often much, much worse than having the mystery there.
Yep.
And lots of times no explanation is going to work, right? You look at something like Lost, right? I'm not sure there was any way they were going to get to the end of that and have everybody go, yes, that explanation worked for me.
Right.
Well, okay. So before we totally wrap up here, I'd like to look at the competition in the year for the book, because this was published in 1989, but it won the 1990 award. So that's how it works.
Right. I was on Wikipedia. I saw those other authors.
Yeah. I actually haven't read it. Any of these others?
Me either.
Prentice Alvin by Orson Scott Card, A Boat of a Million Years by Paul Anderson, and Grass by Sherry S. Tepper, and A Fire in the Sun. Yeah, so I don't know, you know, is this... I mean, when I actually just look at this list, I'm like, well, Hyperion is the one that I've heard of.
Right? Yeah, and those other books don't make, like, top 50 lists either. So, you know, to me, it's sort of like where there's smoke, there's fire, kind of, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, final thoughts, Jeff?
Yeah, very much looking forward to see what they do with it. I think there's quite a treasure trove here for anyone wanting to make a cinematic version of this. And I think because the characters are so rich, a good writer I think Hyperion would really do well on the small screen, where you could do lots of dialogue and get into character and really let the story play out. I don't think you need a ton of money to do Hyperion, because most of it takes place on, you know, you can do CGI backdrops for the different worlds, you know, maybe this because there's not a lot of big star battles. Like you have some of the big battles in The Soldier's Tale, you know, so that there may be some money on the screen there, but, and a little bit for The Detective's Tale when you have to do the diving into the AIs to get the, you know, Keats's other self. But
or even then running across
multiple worlds through the Farcasters, which is a great, great sequence.
Yeah. And I was going to say that doesn't, you know, I don't see that is huge production costs. It's just different sets. And if you did it on the small screen, you could do a very, because the book doesn't rely. And I think this is maybe one of a good final thought, that because the book doesn't rely on this stuff overly, you know, what it, I think what it really, it's brilliantly done and it's there, but I think it rests on its characters. So
yeah,
I feel like when that happens, you have a better chance of making the jump to big screen because, you know, if you do the characters right and the dialogue and you follow them correctly, like, yeah, the world will be there, but the bones of the story rests inside the characters. And so I don't know. I feel like it has a better chance of being something.
Yeah. Well, when that series comes out, if you want to do some special episodes, let me know.
No doubt. No yeah. doubt about it. I will be ridiculously overly critical.
yeah, I bet. And that's the trouble, right? I mean, it's so hard for an adaptation of something to just knock your socks off.
Yeah, I mean, I feel similar about Childhood's End that I do about Hyperion. And Sci-Fi Channel did a Childhood's End, I think, last year.
Yeah, I watched
it. And I gave them credit because they really followed the story to the end. And it's have you read the book?
I have, yeah.
So, you know, it's a hell of an ending. It's a hell of a downer ending in one sense.
It is.
You know, in one sense it's not. In another sense it is. But the Sci-Fi Channel followed it, I thought. I didn't like that they changed the main character to just, you know, some white dude living out in the, you know, rather than, you know, who they had in the book. But, and it wasn't great by any means, but I liked, I forget the actor who plays the main.
Overlord?
Yeah, the main overlord. I forget his name, but he
was Charles Dance, isn't it?
Yeah, thank you. Charles Dance, yeah. He was great and his look was great.
Oh, yeah, he looked tremendous.
Right? Yeah. So, like, I respected what they did with it. I don't think it was a home run by any means, but I was like, you know what? They cleaved to the spirit of the book and took a risk. And I don't know if, you know, it was they considered a success or not, but I feel like the spirit of the book was upheld on the screen, whatever changes they made. So, I guess that's all I would want for Hyperion. You know, my other ridiculously cranky self, I would just kind of leave alone. But if that happened, I think it'd be fine, you know?
Sure. Well, we can start signing off, I think, here, Jeff. So why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of you?
Sure. My podcast is called Sci-Fi On Screen, and it's available on any, you know, smart device, any of the podcast apps that you use. If you just type in Sci-Fi On Screen, sometimes you have to put a space between sci and fi, but for the most part, you should find it. The website is scifionscreen.com, and you can find my podcasts there as well.
Sweet. I'll put all your links in the show notes, and definitely encourage people to go check you out. And I guess we didn't really talk about what your format is.
Yeah, my format is not for everyone, but I take a movie apart scene by scene. So I will just narrate through a film briefly what's going on, and then what I think works or doesn't work about the film. So I feel like I'm not necessarily weighing in on the totality of whether a film is great or not, or 3 stars or 5 stars, but often I think, especially for genre films, that lots of times things work and are great in the film, and other things that are in the film are not so great and don't work. And so I like doing that, where I can go through a film that maybe a lot of people thought was, you know, horrible, but I thought that certain themes that were brought up or certain things that were done in the film were successful. And so it allows me to be more even-handed about the films that I do. And it's also a little bit much if you're willing to hang with me scene by scene, you know, depending on your interest in a particular film. And it's incredibly spoiler. So if you haven't seen it, it might be a little difficult to follow. But, you know, that's kind of how I've been doing it. I've thought about changes to the format for different types of films. But as of yet, I haven't found another one. So,
yeah. No, I really enjoy listening. Like, lots of times there's something I haven't seen in a long time, and I'm like, oh, I want to go back through that, and I'll just kind of let you take me back through it, rather than going back and watching the film again. And then that kind of whets my appetite to go back and watch the film.
Oh, that's perfect, look for some of those things. Yeah.
And like you said, I do appreciate that when you're watching something that's kind of a lackluster film, that doesn't mean there's nothing in the film that was worth watching.
Right.
And likewise with something that's brilliant, you know, occasionally you have scenes that fall a little flat. And,
right.
So I like, that you do kind of take that even-handed approach.
Yeah, thanks.
Cool. Well, I think we can go ahead and basically sign off.
Great. This was a pleasure, man. I really enjoyed this format and talking about Hyperion with you. This is fantastic.
Well, I'm glad, man. I've been wanting to chat with you for a while, you know, thinking about if we should get you on, take me to your reader sometime or cross over in some way. And so, it was really great to finally talk to you because we've chatted a bit, you know, just like on Facebook Messenger and stuff. And I feel like we have similar views on a lot of stuff. And so,
yeah,
it was good to talk to you. And certainly, you know, look down the list. And at some point, everybody's going to take all the ones that everybody wants to do. And I'm going to have to beg people, like, hey, will you read Double Star with me? You know,
go back and read.
You know, that's cool because in a way, there's still a bunch of stuff on the list that I would be a first reader as well. So it would be cool to have two first readers like to tackle an old classic. And like, you know, maybe we can come up with some interesting things to say.
Yeah. And that's what we had to do because for the first one, I wanted to cover The Demolished Man, which was the first book. And so I asked Colin to do it with me because I'm like, I can talk this guy into it. And that was fun because we were both first time readers and we were both pretty delighted with how enjoyable the book was.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard that. It was a good podcast.
Yeah. Thanks, man. So Jeff, thanks so much for doing this, man. And hope we get to do it again.
All right, man. This was great.
Take care, man.
Be well.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Jeff. I know I did. And I hope that you will go over and check him out at scifionscreen.com or follow him on Twitter at scifionscreen. On the next episode, I will be talking with Lisa Schmeiser, and we're going to be discussing William Gibson's Neuromancer, so that should be great fun. Before I sign off, I do want to ask you to go and rate and review us in the iTunes Store or Stitcher or Google Play, as that will help increase the profile of the show. Also, follow us on social media. You can find us facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast or at Hugo's Podcast on Twitter. And the website is hugospodcast.com. And you can leave us a comment there on the post for the episode, or you can fill out the contact form there, or you can just shoot me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com. And I think that's going to do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.